So, Rabbi Peter Tarlow was the director and rabbi of Texas A&M Hillel for 30 years. Rabbi Tarlow retired on July 1st, 2013. That's coming up on our anniversary there. Becoming rabbi emeritus. Rabbi Tarlow came to Texas A&M Hillel from Santiago, Chile. Upon retirement, he assumed the leadership of the Center for Latino-Jewish Relations. Rabbi Tarlow writes a weekly bilingual social religious commentary that is read through the United States and Latin America, and a monthly philosophy column for the Bryan Eagle. Rabbi Tarlow has been a chaplain for the College Station Police Department since 1988, and until the COVID pandemic, worked with the Bryan, Texas Federal Prison Camp from 87 till 2020. So you have a lot of involvement with the Spanish-speaking world, right?
Yes,
And
sir.
works and Rabbi Tarlow works with the Jewish communities in Bolivia, Mexico, and Peru, and is an expert on Sephardic and crypto-Jewish history, and organizes in conjunction with universities around the United States Southwest lectures on Sephardic history and culture. Rabbi Tarlow lectures on the impact of the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions on both European and American Jewry, and also works in conjunction with the Jewish Heritage Alliance to educate American Jews on the history and culture of Jewish Iberian Peninsula experience and its aftermath. I think that's a pretty good intro.
Great.
All right. So without further ado, please go ahead.
Thank you. First, before I begin, I want to thank Leo for all the work that he's done. And also, I want to thank Linda Rosenzweig for all the work that she's done in getting this month to be a huge success. So I really appreciate their work and anybody else who worked on these projects. Today's topic is going to deal with the Jewish contribution to the founding of the United States. So more or less, I'm going to end around the time of the Declaration of Independence. So I am going to cheat a little bit and end with both a letter from George Washington, President Washington at the time, and then also with the famous poem, which is at the base of the Statue of Liberty. But I'm going to start this actually dealing in Portugal, because it's really from Portugal that the American Jewish community indirectly gets founded. Very quickly, and this is not a lecture on Portuguese Inquisition, but Portugal received the Inquisition from Spain, basically against its will, in the early part of the 16th century. And the Portuguese Inquisition was so bad, so cruel, that people ran from Portugal back to Spain to escape the Portuguese Inquisition. In other words, the Spanish Inquisition was actually lighter and easier. I won't go into much detail about it, but suffice to say that this was a very difficult period. Under Inquisition law, you were considered guilty until proven innocent. The state did not have to tell you what your crime was. Instead, they had the right to torture you until you told the state what your crime was. And then
Sorry,
because,
Repetella, just real quick, if you're sh are you trying to share slides by any chance or no?
no, I'm not.
Okay, all right, because we weren't seeing anything. All right,
No,
please
there are
continue.
no slides because they really wouldn't, you don't want to see people being tortured.
Well, okay, thank you.
Yes, I have no slides. This is going to have to be an oral presentation, but I'll try to be dynamic enough that I won't lose anybody, I promise. The Portuguese Inquisition was so terrible that people started to look for ways to flee. And you couldn't go to many countries because you were only allowed out of Portugal if you went to a recognized Inquisitional country. Some people went to Holland, and that's why the Dutch Jewish community is Sephardic by nature. Some people went to Brazil. And if you look at the map of Brazil and you see Recife, you'll see that's where it looks like Brazil would fit into Africa. In other words, it looks like the two of them were kind of pulled apart. And we know that there was a Jewish community in the beginnings of the 17th century. Holland reconquered that part of Brazil. And wherever, and after Dutch independence came, Jews basically had full rights. Matter of fact, everyone in Holland had full rights except Catholics. And that was a reaction to the Portuguese and the Portuguese and Spanish domination of the Low Countries. So Jews did go to Recife. It is guesstimated, and none of these figures are 100% correct, because nobody really knows. They didn't keep careful data, so they're guesstimates and not even estimates. But it's estimated there were about 5,000 Europeans in Recife, of which 2,500, that's 5,000 men. They did not count women in the census. So 5,000 European men, of which 2,500 were Jewish males. So approximately 50% of the population of Recife was Jewish. Now, how many of those people were actually Jewish? How many of those people were Catholics who now became crypto-Catholics? In other words, they hid their Catholicism and became Jewish and because it was safer. Or how many people just found Jewish roots again? That's unclear. The data really does not indicate that. But we know that approximately 50% of the people in Recife were somewhat connected to the Jewish community. Of course, they immediately founded a synagogue, which then had a fight in typical Jewish way, and ended up with having three synagogues. So there was the synagogue to go to, the synagogue to be met at, and the synagogue that was the other guys. The Jewish community in Recife comes to an end in 1653, 1654, depending on how you want to count, when the Portuguese reconquer Recife. Now, that's really important from an American Jewish perspective, because for the first time, Jews, a part of the agreement of surrender was that Jews would leave Recife as Dutch citizens. And this is the first time in European history where a major European country recognizes Jews as Dutch citizens. Most of those people went back to Amsterdam. A few of those people got lost and ended up in Curaçao. And if you've ever been to Curaçao, the oldest synagogue in the New World is called Mikveh Israel, and that is a national, one of the great national symbols of Curaçao. And that synagogue is still in operation. So if you're in Curaçao, you can visit it. 23 families, approximately, 24 families, got lost because of winds and ended up in the next Dutch port of call, which was New Amsterdam, better known today as New York. Now, we believe there may have been one or two Jews present prior to 1654. That's unclear because they didn't keep any records. There certainly was not a permanent Jewish community. But by 1654, there were the presence not only of men, but also of women and children. And that would indicate to us that there was a pure, that there was a desire to establish a real functioning Jewish community, and not just somebody who wandered in along the way. We know that the first Jew to arrive in America, his name was Jacob Bar Simmons. He's later followed by these 23 Jewish men, women, and children, and they sailed into the colony of New Amsterdam. We think the ship's name was the Sainte Catherine, but that's really questionable, but that appears to be the correct name. The time of they arrived, there was a real anti-Semite by the name of Peter Stuyvesant. He was governor of New Amsterdam, and he had absolutely no desire for Jews to come to land. He did everything he could to keep Jews from being able to come into New Amsterdam. And his basic theory was that if you allow Jews to settle in the country, then the next thing that's going to happen is you're going to have Lutherans and Catholics coming. So in order to keep anyone who was not part of the Dutch Reformed Church out of New Amsterdam, he said, you let the Jews come in, wow, more is going to happen. Now, what's really interesting about that is I remember growing up in New Jersey that people would say, well, if you allow Jews into a neighborhood, they'll eventually be followed by Blacks and Hispanics. So you see that same sociological pattern taking place. Again, he did. His arguments were that Jews were hateful enemies of Jesus, and if once you allow Jews in, all sorts of other terrible people like Lutherans and Catholics would come in. Obviously, this was a gentleman who was not much on multiculturalism, to say the least. He did everything possible to avoid any form of political or religious pluralism. And he wanted to make sure that there was one standard way of thinking, one standard way of working, one standard culture, and it was Dutch, and that would be it. The Jews said, we're not playing with this. We are Dutch citizens. And they wrote back to the Dutch West Indies Company, which owned New Amsterdam, and they said, we're not going anyplace. And they received a letter from the Dutch West Indies Company saying that Jews should be permitted to travel, trade, and live in New Amsterdam, or then called New Netherland. The only conditions were that they provide for the poor among them, they will not become a burden to the community, and they will support their own nation, meaning the Jewish people. Usually this was understood both by the government in New Amsterdam and by Peter Stuyvesant as requiring four basic things, and they really changed all of American Jewish history. One is that Jews were understood that they would develop their own cemeteries. They would not be in Christian cemeteries. Until today, we have Jewish cemeteries. Two, Jews would establish their own hospitals. And again, some of the best hospitals in the United States today are Jewish hospitals. Three, Jews would develop their own agencies or welfare agencies. And again, we see that up until today. And the last one that he insisted upon, which was really a gift, he meant it to be anti-Semitic, but it was a real gift to the Jewish people. He said the Jews would have to stand guard against, they can see, the Brooklyn Indians. Why that was important is this is going to be the first time the Jews have weapons in their hands since the fall of Masada. And secondly, once you give somebody a gun, once you give somebody a weapon, you can no longer make that person a second-class citizen. It will also open the door to Jewish participation in the Revolutionary War. So I don't think Peter Stuyvesant meant for this to be a wonderful act by any means at all, but he ended up doing us a major favor. And I think we have much to thank him, even though he didn't want us to be thanked. He didn't want us to do it. So Jews are allowed to settle in New Amsterdam or New Netherlands, however, depending upon which document you read. And they immediately began as citizens to petition for full and further rights. And again, this will now become a major concept that will take place throughout the American Constitution. So by 1655, just 1 year, 2 years after they arrived, they had petitioned and won the right to own their own homes, the right to legally trade both in the Dutch colonies and abroad. And that meant that they would create a true network of Jewish interactions throughout all of the Dutch colonies. That meant that people were trading from the Caribbean to Europe to Brazil. And that wherever there were Jewish communities, this was a real Atlantic community, including marriages were made. So people, if they didn't find a wife in one colony, they ended up finding a wife in some other colony. And the last thing that they won by 1655 is that there would be no Jewish special Jewish tax. In other words, Jews would pay the same tax rate, the same fair share of taxes as everyone else. Now you can see how this is going to open the gates eventually when the United States is founded as an independent nation. This kind of becomes the cornerstone of the Jewish community in the United States. There were other arrivals that came in 1650s, 55, 56. And by the end of 1655, there was enough of a Jewish community in New Amsterdam to have a separate Jewish burial ground, as they had agreed to. And a Torah scroll was lent to them by a synagogue in Amsterdam. So again, you can see they're really founding now an established community. Many of them, on the other hand, were not thrilled with the Dutch, and a large amount of the colony ended up immigrating to the British colonies, which was considered more stable than the Dutch colonies, and also had more economic opportunities and more political opportunities. We do know of one Jew who stayed in New Amsterdam. His name was Asser Levy, and he maintained his Jewish observance throughout his life in New Amsterdam. He demanded full civil status, both from the Dutch and British authorities, and he lived until 1682. So again, he's really one of the great founders of the American Jewish community. Now, what's remarkable about the earliest Jewish communities is that they were unremarkable. And let me say that again. The early American Jews were unremarkable, and that kind of makes them remarkable. And what I mean by that is they looked and behaved like anyone else. Let me distinguish between assimilation and acculturation. Acculturation, most of us are acculturated. That means if we walk down the street, you don't see something particularly Jewish. If I scratch you, I discover you're Jewish. But they, on the whole, our English is the same as everybody else. Our dress codes are the same as everybody else. Our customs are the same as everybody else. So we have acculturated into the general society. There are exceptions. For example, the Hasidic community is easily recognizable because of their dress and their hairstyles. But most American Jews were well acculturated. Assimilated means that not only are you acculturated, but you're no longer part of the world. You now cease to be who you were. So Jews were not assimilated, but they were acculturated. They wore the same clothing as everybody else. They lived in the same types of homes. They lived basically incredibly normal lives. And if you put this, now that doesn't seem much today, but remember, you're in the 17th century or beginnings of the 18th century. Life in Europe was not that way at all. So this is a new concept. Their worries were not about somebody killing them, but rather about their children earning a living. They had synagogue fights. They were interested in purchasing cemeteries. And they had a very international outlook. Again, they worked with Jewish communities in the Caribbean and across the North Atlantic. By the 18th century, you have Jewish communities in Newport, Rhode Island, Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, among the, and these were certainly the major Jewish communities. We could also say that each community, they had what we might call irregular receptions. There were some communities that were very welcoming. There were communities that were less welcoming. But throughout the colonies, they did prosper. They brought not only economic benefits to themselves, they made it part of their genre, of their way of living, to hire non-Jews, in other words, to provide economic benefits to the local community. For the most part, they also supported George Washington in the Revolution. There were some who were Tories, and some of those people went to Canada. But the great majority of Jews, once they thought about it, they were kind of with the Revolution. They won the right of full citizenship. In my own state of New Jersey, by the middle of the 1700s, the 18th century, Jews had already won public office. And in Somerset County, for those of you who know New Jersey, the first sheriffs and tax collectors were openly Jewish. So it gives you an idea of where they were, at least in one part of the colonies in New Jersey. Interestingly enough, Jews were not monolithic in their politics. Most Jews tended to vote as individuals. There was no such thing as a Jewish voting bloc. And I might argue that today, the Jewish community is probably less monolithic than it was, or more monolithic than it was at the time. Now, one of the important things that we gave to the United States, I'll speak about more of these in a second, was the modern notion of religious and ethnic pluralism. Today, we take that pretty much for granted. In the 18th century, that was considered very strange. There were restricted Christian oaths, which meant that you could not be in often in public office or in various professions. And Jews fought for the idea of a separation of church and state and for the concept that of ethnic and religious pluralism, that the colonies were not of one religion, but rather that they would be of every religion, and you would judge each human being by the character of his soul and the character of his quality. Somebody like Martin Luther King was highly inspired by the work that they did. Jews, despite some of the early fights, administered estates. They served as guardians. They sat on juries. They marched with the militia. And they patrolled streets, as I just mentioned, especially in New Jersey, as constables and what was then called members of the watch. Now, watch, W-A-T-C-H, was the earliest form of policing. It's not until the 19th century that we see what we would today call police. But in those days, it was a neighborhood watch, and Jews were considered part of that neighborhood watch. That meant we were really now part of the community. They did, however, face some major challenges. One, they had to figure out, how do you meld a completely diverse Jewish community into a cohesive Jewish community? They were separated by geography, by politics, by where they came from. And to add to it, there was no state tax. In other words, in Europe, even to today, you pay a tax, which then goes to, hypothetically, the churches and synagogues, certainly to the churches, in some cases, the synagogues. And the Jewish community had to create a community based on purely voluntary contributions. Basically, fundraising begins in the United States with the Jewish community. Secondly, they had to figure out a way to establish the rights of Jews to be full citizens and yet have the right to differ from the majority, the Christian community, without prejudice. And what, again, that means is this is the beginning of minority rights. The fact that you have a right in a democracy not to necessarily be part of the majority. You don't have a right to dictate to the majority, but you do have a right to live your life. And the majority does not have a right to destroy your life. Those concepts are introduced into the American culture, basically, by the Jewish community. And thirdly, Jews had to figure out how to will they preserve their Jewish distinctiveness in an open society where they could mix freely with Jews and non-Jews. Now, there are a few other historical precedents to that. We know that in the 17th century in Poland, there was somewhat a similar situation. But on the whole, this was really considered a strange concept to maintain who you are, your ethnicity, and yet to be part of the greater whole. And this is the first time that this is really thought about in the United States. So, to early American culture, Jews offered many gifts. One of the things we taught America was the concept of multiculturalism. I don't have to be like you to like you. I don't have to be the same as you to have the same rights as you. That's a Jewish concept that came into America. The idea of freedom of religion, it took a long time, but that was first introduced by the fact that Jews argued they were full participants in the American experiment, but they had a different religion. The concept of protecting a minority and still recognizing the rights of majority. These are new concepts. People had not thought about them. This becomes a whole new way that people are going to begin to think. And that's going to change not only the United States, but much of American law and constitutional law. There was the issues of identity. While being part of a total community, how do you maintain your ethnicity without becoming totally assimilated? So these ideas started to enter the mainstream. Other ideas that people really had not thought about, the concept of the weekend. And from the weekend, we get the concept of vacation. Now, Lior didn't mention it, but my PhD in the area that I work in is in tourism, besides my Jewish side. And you would have no tourism if it were not for the concept first of Shabbat, then of the weekend, and then the basic underlying principle, human beings are not machines. That human beings have a right to do things other than just work. And through much of the world, the norm was you get born, somebody raises you till you're 3 or 4 or 5, you work, you drop dead, and the game is over. Jews argued first through the concepts of Shabbat and then through the idea of a weekend that people have the right to more to life than just going to work every day until they drop dead. Jews also insisted on an accurate census. Prior to this, you didn't count. And we still see this in the Constitution, where the argument is, do you count blacks or not count blacks? Today, we're having the argument, do you count the population of state by American citizens, or do you count the population of state by the number of people who happen to be residing, be they a citizen or not? So the Jewish community really fought for the idea of an accurate census. Another concept that we gave to American culture was the right of asylum for the persecuted. Again, this was not a general concept understood in the 18th or even 19th centuries, but it was a Jewish concept that came through. Now, much of this came through because many of the non-Jews who lived in the United States were highly biblically based. And as we will talk in just a few moments, almost all of the founders of the American Republic, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, the people who wrote the Constitution, were fairly well versed in the biblical world. So many biblical concepts came through through the Bible, through the Jewish Hebrew Bible, and then came into American culture. And many of our founders were quite familiar, if not in original Hebrew, at least in English translation, with what they would have called the Old Testament, or we would call Tanakh, the Hebrew scripture. So the idea of asylum was one of those. Another concept that came through very clearly because of the biblical tradition was equality under the law. You don't treat someone unequally just because you don't like them. You don't find someone guilty or innocent because the guy is your friend, the guy is your enemy. You stick strictly to the law, and the law should be blind. That meant they also created, through biblical literature, the idea of a court system with the right of appeal. And lastly, something that most of us don't think about, animal rights. Animal rights are a Jewish concept. To the best of my knowledge, Judaism is the only religion that has, as part of a mitzvah, of a protection, the idea that animals are not to be tortured or to be treated poorly. And so the concept of animal rights comes into the United States through the Jewish community. Two other things that are probably incredibly important to this country, and comes from the biblical heritage brought in through the Jewish community and then into general population, was that when you go to court and there are damages, damages can be done not just by killing the person, not just by the death penalty, but rather there are gradations of damages, and damages can be canceled through money. In other words, the idea of a fine. So if you go through a red light, I don't throw you in jail and beat the you-know-what out of you. I just give you a fine. Finally, the last concept that will enter into the colonies is the concept of universal education. Now, that basic concept is first developed by Ezra and Nehemiah after the Jewish people come back from the Babylonian exile. And those are basic Jewish concepts that a compulsory universal education. Now, they also came up with some really direct things that I want to speak about. And some of those I will be able to tell the person who pushed them through. For example, Asser Levy, refused to give in to prejudice. He demanded and received the right for Jews to be in the armed forces. And he demanded and won the concept of religious freedom. Those are major victories that come into the United States through the Jewish community. Coming towards the revolution, we see that hundreds of Jews fought under General Washington. And I'm going to speak to just about a few people, because if not, this would go on forever. But one of the names I'd like to bring about is Chaim Salem. He was a major contributor to the Continental Army. He was so loved that he was named Treasurer of the Army by the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Again, today this doesn't seem like a huge victory, but we're talking, the country does not yet exist legally, and the idea that a Jew would become the Treasurer of the Continental Congress, of the Army, was unheard of prior to this. There were other Jews who worked hard, and by the way, Chaim Salem gave so much of his own personal wealth, especially in Valley Forge. Probably he's one of the most important people in making sure that George Washington and the army did not go bankrupt. Some of the other Jewish people who really worked in the development of the history of the United States is Mordecai Sheftal. He lived in Savannah. He was a strong believer in U.S. independence, and he worked for the raising of money and accomplishes so that the soldiers had uniforms and regular food rations. Again, without food, an army doesn't function. Colonel Solomon Bush fought in numerous battles. He was and recognized as one of the great American heroes after the Revolutionary War. Colonel Philip Moses Russell was George Washington's surgeon and doctor at Valley Forge. Needless to say, he had a major contribution in the winning of the war. And other people such as Isaac Moses, Aaron Lopez, Michael Gratz, and Joseph Simon gave large sums of their personal money in order for the revolution to succeed. So I want to talk about three members of the Jewish community in particular, because I think they all teach us something. The first one's name is Gershom Mendes Seixas, S-E-I-X-A-S, obviously of Portuguese origin. He was known in New York as the Patriot Rabbi. He lived 1745 to 1816. And why he should be important is, unfortunately, all of us have seen what went on in Columbia University. Seixas was one of the incorporators of Columbia. He served 30 years on its first Board of Regents. He was the only Jew and probably the sole non-Episcopalian to hold such a prominent position at Columbia. He was a major supporter of President Washington. And in 1789, President Washington spoke about the need for a Thanksgiving Day. The great Patriot Rabbi Seixas gave a discourse in his synagogue in New York that became so beloved, so cared for, that the New York Daily Gazette, which was kind of like the New York Times of the 18th century, wrote in December 23rd of 1789 that his sermon was the first of its kind ever preached in English and is highly deserving of the attention of every pious reader, whether Jew or Christian. It breathes nothing but pure morality and devotion. Now, to have a rabbi's sermon published in the leading newspaper of New York City in the late 18th century was not a small event. I think that, you know, he would have been absolutely aghast at what's going on at Columbia University today. I won't go into politics, but certainly he was one of the people who worked so hard for major education in the United States, universities. And his concept was that universities should be a place where people can peacefully discuss, exchange ideas, and learn from each other. So clearly one of the founders of the first of many of the Ivy Leagues. Interestingly enough, in the 18th century, it was considered a mark of a gentleman to know Hebrew. And if you look at the seal both of Harvard and of Yale, you'll see that Hebrew is on it. To a great extent, it was assumed that if you could not read biblical Hebrew, you were really poorly educated. And so educated people were educated, obviously, in English, but also in the ability to speak French, the ability to read either Latin or Greek, and always Hebrew. So again, you can see the incredible Jewish emphasis in the United States. I really wanted this to go up to the Revolutionary War, and I'm going to speak about that in a second, but I'm not going to end it with that point. Instead, I'm going to talk about someone with a very similar name, but a different person, by the name of Moises Seixas. Now, Seixas, again, spelled S-E-I-X-A-S. He lived 1744 to 1809. Definitely, they were same last name, but different people. He was the leader of the Jewish community of Rhode Island. And he was probably best known because he wrote a letter to President George Washington in 1790, which was when George Washington made a trip to New England, which was not easy in those days, and stopped in Rhode Island. Now, if he came to the Newport Synagogue, is some people say yes, and some people say no, so I'll leave it as an open question. But he wrote a letter on behalf of the congregation. He expressed his gratitude for the freedom and religious tolerance enjoyed by the American Jews. And General Washington was so, or President Washington was so moved by his letter that he wrote a famous letter, which is now known as the Letter to the Hebrew Congregation in Newport, which affirmed the nation's commitment to religious freedom and equality. And that letter I'm going to read to you right now, it was from Newport, where he was written to Newport, Rhode Island, on the 18th of August, 1790. And President Washington writes, "Gentlemen, while I receive with much satisfaction your address, replete with expressions of affection and esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain a grateful remembrance of the cordial welcome I expressed in my visit to Newport from all of its citizens." Again, it's unclear if he actually was in the synagogue or not. "The reflection of the days of difficulty and danger, which are past, is rendered the more sweet from a consciousness that they are succeeded by days of uncommon prosperity and security. If we have wisdom to make the best use of the advantages with which we are now favored, we cannot fail, under the just administration of a good government, to become a great and happy people. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possesses alike liberty of conscience and immunity of citizenship. It is now no more that tolerance is spoken of, as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens, and giving it on all occasions their effectual support. It would be inconsistent with the frankness of my character not to avow that I am pleased with your favorable opinion of my administration and fervent wishes for my felicity. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants. Well, everyone shall sit in it safely under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make them afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light, not darkness, in our paths, make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in its own time and way everlasting happy. Signed, President George Washington." Now, Washington's statement has set up really at a time when, unfortunately, we don't always live by his concepts, really the basis of not only for Jewish life in this country, but for every minority life. The fact is that everyone should have the right to live without fear, without prejudice, and be able to live their life to the best of their ability while not hurting anybody else's life. That perhaps is one of the great gifts that the Jewish people have given. Now, obviously, at another time, I could speak about hundreds of Jewish individuals who have given tremendous amounts of knowledge, from sports to science, from the theater to the movies. But I just wanted to end with one last person, because I think she symbolizes so much. And her name is Emma Lazarus. She lived a very short life, 1849 to 1897. She was of Sephardic heritage. She was from an upper-class family. And she was a poetess by definition. She was part of a class, a family that had even Supreme Court justices connected to it. So she was not by any way, someone who was not part of the mainstream. But she was shocked by the way that immigrants were treated to the United States, especially the fact that Jewish immigrants spent so much time in terrible conditions working in the garment districts of New York City, something which I can connect to because my grandparents and great-grandparents were in those situations and in some of the true slums of the Lower East Side of New York. But she was asked, because of her tremendous literary skills, to write a special poem to be placed at the bottom of the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. And I should say, there's a really big debate if the United States wanted the Statue of Liberty. And General Grant, President Grant, put it on Liberty Island because he figured, nobody will go there, so it'll be out of the way. The United States really, people wondered if this was just a crazy idea. So today, of course, it's one of the great symbols of the United States. But at the time, it wasn't. She never wrote that poem, but she did write another poem that is now at the base, and that's called The New Colossus. It was engraved in 1903 at the base of the Statue of Liberty. And that's kind of like, before I open it up to any questions, where I'd like to end, because I think she says so much of the spirit of both the American Jewish community. She was a proud member of the Jewish community. She fought strongly for Jewish rights, and she fought strongly for a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel. But her words were words of welcome to the United States, the new Colossus. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with concrete limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beaconed hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities fame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp besides the golden door. And I think no person better expresses truly the American Jewish experience than Emma Lazarus. So I think this is a kind of a great way the Jewish Heritage Month will be coming to an end in just a few days. But the contributions that we have given to the United States, the number of people, the concepts, the ideas. And again, today I tried to speak only up to the revolution, are such that every American has a stake in American Jewish history. And while we might call it Jewish Heritage Month, really perhaps a better name would be the month when Jews gave to the American heritage, because all of us have a debt of gratitude to what these people in the 17th and 18th century did for the beacon of light that shines forth today at the Statue of Liberty. So I thank you, and I promise to leave about 10 minutes for questions. So if anyone has a question, this is time to ask. Thank you, Lior.
Yes, thank you. That was wonderful. Anybody who has any questions, yeah, please raise your hand so we can go in order. You may or may not put your camera on as you choose. I saw one go up really quick and then come down again. So But yeah, please, anybody with any questions?
If not, go have lunch, which is a very Jewish thing to do.
That's right. Yes, Jonathan. Oh, I'm sorry, Gary, excuse me. Gary was first. My apologies.
Just you've presented such an amazing amount of information today. I just wondered where you recommend to start to if we wanted to follow up on that.
That's a good question. And there was a wonderful four-part series published by Johns Hopkins University on the history of the American Jews. It's a lot of reading, so you know, but you could certainly. But he doesn't. It's a four-part series, so you could do book by book. But that is probably the best general history of the American Jewish community.
Can you send a reference to that as a to my email, maybe, so I can share it with folks?
Yeah, no, you can find it on Amazon. I think it's called The American Jewish Experience. If I don't have the book in front of me right now. But okay. It was published by Johns Hopkins University. It's a four-volume series.
Okay. Thank you. Jonathan.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Lior, and thank you so much for this talk. This is really, really interesting. I was, I've been thinking about your early definitions of what you gave at the beginning of your talk about assimilation and acculturation. Yeah. And, you know, you can tell or you can't tell if somebody's a Jew from just walking down the street. I think my question is as follows. I'd like to hear your reaction to this statement, you know, that Jews were uniquely positioned to contribute to American culture as a minority because many of them, you know, were white or of European descent. What are your reactions to that that sort of a statement?
I don't think that it was had anything to do with skin color. First of all, Jews were not considered white by most Europeans. They were considered whatever it means, because there's no such word as Semitic, but whatever that was, they were. But they certainly Hitler, all the way through Hitler. Hitler didn't just come out of nowhere. Hitler did not consider Jews to be white. They were not considered to be Europeans. They were considered to be Middle Easterners living on European soil. I don't think, therefore, that that would be my reaction. I think my reaction was that Jews were definitely had a tradition of education and had a tradition of community. And those two traditions allowed them to succeed very quickly. Most Americans did not necessarily consider Jews to be white. That's a 21st century construct that was, they would have said, what are you talking about? So I don't think it'd be skin color. On top of that, we know that we had Jews of multiple colorations. And I didn't mention, but I should have, that one of the people who probably was Jewish, but he never really pushed it, was Alexander Hamilton, who had a bar mitzvah, came from the Caribbean, certainly set up the American economic area. He did come from but he came from St. Nevis, and they're very proud of him. When he came to the United States, he never said he was a Christian. He just kind of avoided religion. So was that because of fear, or we don't know. But we do know that he went to Hebrew school and he did have a bar mitzvah. So that would be my reaction.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Larry.
Yeah, I had a question, and maybe I'm reaching beyond the scope of this webinar, but you had mentioned the Jewish contribution of bringing protection of minorities to America. Right. And I'm wondering, you know, I know, and I've been told by a number of friends who are lawyers, that the Bill of Rights in our Constitution, first 10 amendments, were basically put there as a method or a means to make sure minorities were protected. And I wonder if there were Jewish contributions to those amendments being in our Constitution.
I would think it'd be almost impossible for those amendments to have taken place if the founding fathers were, one, unfamiliar with the biblical tradition. And when I say the biblical tradition, I mean the Jewish biblical tradition. And two, with Jews. Now, how much we know that many of these people studied carefully the Hebrew Bible. So none of this came as a shock to them. This was, they saw themselves as a new Israel. And if you look at the names, especially in New England, Salem, Massachusetts, is just Shalom. Rehoboth in wide places, Rehovot in Hebrew. You see consistency of Hebrew names throughout the colonies, which came because of the fact that they understood this concept. The idea of Thanksgiving is a Jewish concept, Sukkot, and the idea of thanking God. And that concept was originally in the United States in the October. It only moves to November because of the Civil War, and they needed people to for the harvest. So they moved the date. But the pilgrims saw themselves, even though they weren't very pro-Jewish, but the pilgrims saw themselves as a new Israel. And that was one of the reasons why the mark of a gentleman was the ability to read Hebrew. So I would find it almost unimaginable that you would have the Ten Amendments without a prior Jewish influence. Now, again, it's, you know, nobody wrote me a sentence saying, because of the Jews, we put in the Ten Amendments as Bill of Rights. But I cannot imagine they were not floating around.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good question.
Okay. Any final questions? Okay.
Well, let me just say, I do send out a biblical, weekly, it's both Spanish and English commentary on the week's parasha. And if anybody, Lior, you're more than welcome to give out my email. Mm-hmm. If anybody would like to get that, and I write a monthly philosophy article for the local paper, but it's sent out all over the world. If you write to me, I'll be more than glad to put you on the list.
Okay. Will do.
Okay. Well, I thank everyone, and let's hope that next year we go from strength to even greater strength for Jewish Heritage Month. And again, thank you, and thank Linda for all the work that you guys have done in making this happen.
Yes, thank you to everybody who helped pull this together. And thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
We will see you next time.
I hope so. And next time I'm in Maryland, I'd love to come and get to meet some of you guys.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
Yeah, have a wonderful day.
Thanks, everybody. I am stopping the recording.